Cancer Action, New York's Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Revolution. Joining us today is Dustin Johnson. He is a member of the First Nations. He is also an employee of the Sierra Club Prairie Chapter. Right now he's speaking to us from Edmonton, Alberta. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being on this call. We have been, I think it is true to state that my favorite interviews, the most exciting interviews that I have been doing during the whole course of our program, which is our series, which has lasted now since May of 2009. I just love doing these stuffed tar sense interviews, and I'm so happy to have you to speak with us. Give us a little more, give us more of your kind of your CV, your resume, your background. You know, who is Dustin Johnson, and what is your involvement with the Sierra Club Prairie Chapter, and then we'll get going on the tar sands.
Well, I'm from the Tsimshian people from the northwest coast. It's just south of southeast Alaska, and roughly our people's territory is one third of the northwest BC coast.
Okay.
And our people's never signed treaties or surrendered a title to the territory, so we haven't relinquished title to the land. And just as with our neighbors, we still have our traditional hereditary governance system in place for our longhouse culture, and most of BC is like that.
That sounds like quite a special life history, quite a special place to have come from. I'm sure your roots are deep in that. It has a large effect on what you are doing over in Edmonton and what you do for the Prairie Chapter of the Sierra Club, and they're very fortunate to have someone like you on board. Tell me, tell me a little more. It just sounds so interesting what you're saying about the longhouse culture and about having the local governance and having never, that nothing truly changed as far as your relationship to the land and in your kind of your role there, and not having anything to interfere with that from any kind of treaties or any kind of agreements with the Canadian government. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, right now, our nations and a lot of our neighbors were tied up in the BC Treaty process, and the BC Treaty process is sent by the government to pacify and suppress our underlying Indigenous sovereignty. And that BC Treaty process was put in place because of what happened when the Oka crisis in 1990, when the Mohawks rose up. There was many solidarity actions by Indigenous nations across Canada and states, and a lot of them were in BC. So the Canadian and BC governments were pretty concerned. So they devised this process to pacify and co-opt our Indigenous people, and the political rage that was happening. So the BC Treaty process is basically what kind of sprung up to, like a stalling and deflecting tactic to get people wrapped up in courts and to try to undermine our sovereignty. So a lot of people, a lot of nations have dropped out of that process, and they're still trying to, rely upon our traditional laws. And that's what really gives people the strength, is the traditional laws and a connection to, to be stewards over our territories.
Right. Yeah, I love you guys have such a good vibe. I was very excited by that, that Mohawk activity there at Oka. And you see, every once in a while you'll see, a thread of that. My brother David and I, we were camping up on the James Bay Road, up in James Bay lowlands of Nouveau Quebec, like quite some time ago. And we were in this camp, and on the wall, there was this little message where this someone, and I'm sure it was a First Nations person, had written something about the forgotten path, and that the blind were leading the blind, and that people had to go back to the forgotten path. And that really struck a chord with my brother. He's just, his happiest times are in wilderness, and he just, when he saw that, he was quoting that to me over and over again for quite some period of time, and this thing of the forgotten path, and that how people needed to go back to it. And I do. I think we'd all truly be better off if we went back to Stone Age, because it certainly was a better path than what I see around me in these days of 2000s. It's just really, things have just gotten, the tar sands, just gotten worse and worse if you look at the big picture. You know, there's some little things that are improving, but in the big picture, I feel like that those that don't honor the forgotten path are just kind of gradually tightening their grip on power and controlling more and more parts of life and ruining more and more parts of life so that we don't have some of the things we need to be okay and do our thing to avoid that mistaken path they're on. I think these are really a very challenging times to exist in, but it's exciting. You know, it's very exciting. So tell me, what were the steps that led you to be on the team of the Sierra Club Prairie chapter?
Well, I have done some organizing around tar sands before because there's a specific project that for a tar sands expansion project from northern Alberta to the BC Northwest Coast, where I'm from, and that's the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. And so that's one of the biggest projects to come out of the tar sands for in terms of proposed infrastructure. And what it is, it's a dual pipeline over 1,200 kilometers distance, and they want to transport up to 525,000 barrels of bitumen per day. Wow. And basically, it would go through the territories of 40 communities, most of which have never surrendered title to the territory and haven't been consulted on an adequate basis. And it would cross over 1,000 watersheds, including rivers, creeks, and streams, and many of which are salmon-bearing and pristine boreal forest. So that was like a very big concern for a lot of people in where I'm from, and all over BC and Alberta. So I got involved in that kind of organizing, and then that led me to Sierra Club, where they're doing similar work.
Yep. Well, tell me this: how is that work, going? Repeat the name of that project, because I want like people to hear that name and be able to like and spell it, so that maybe they could Google search it and just learn more and more about that. That sounds like a very, very, very important project. The name of that pipeline project?
That's the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline.
Enbridge, like ENBRIDGE.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they're the largest pipeline company in North America.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the name of a pipeline company, and where do they, just where do they want to end up on the BC coast?
In Kitimat, BC.
Okay, so Kitimat.
Okay. Kitimat is K-I-T-I-M-A-T.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm sure people are going to want to investigate, this further. We've talked some about the Enbridge pipeline. Give me some more information about the activism. What is being done by the people that don't want the Enbridge pipeline to cross these special lands? What's being done?
This previous 6 months, there's been a lot of opposition and resistance to Enbridge, and in particular, mostly in BC. And there was a few actions during the Joint Review Panel process. And the first one began in Kitimat. That's where the proposed liquefied natural gas port is going to be built right at the end of Enbridge's proposed Gateway pipeline, and where, if built, if successful, they would facilitate the rise of 250 super tanker traffic throughout the Northwest Coast per year, when there's only like around 30 right now. And those are, 10 times larger than the Exxon Valdez, and Exxon Valdez oil spill is always used as an example.
Right.
So what happened at the first joint review panel process, this is like the second or third round, I believe. This is the seventh round of community advisory board, which always follows the joint review panel process. But Enbridge has had to go through this process again and again because they're trying to convince the public and politicians and political leaders from all different backgrounds to embrace and to co-opt into accepting this this proposal. So the first joint review panel process in event this summer was met by resistance from hereditary chiefs from the Northwest Coast, from the Haiza, the Halsuk, and the Tsimshian, and as well as the Haida. And what they did is they organized our counter event right outside the building where the joint review panel process was being held. And they had hereditary chiefs who are, traditional governance authority in the territories, not the government, not the Canadian government. It's the hereditary chiefs.
Right.
And they came in with their traditional gear, dancing in their regalia, and they announced their history and their title to the territory. And then they told everyone that there's an event outside, so they had people speaking outside, and all kinds of politicians from the NDP to Liberals, who are the opposition to the Conservatives, who are the minority but ruling party in Canada, and all kinds of people from up and down the coast. And so that was a successful event, you know, about 300 people in an area that never really had that kind of diverse activism. Mostly it's been around like certain cultural groups. So that one kind of united different social sectors, and that was good to see. And the following week in Prince George, which is the northern central BC, is pretty close to a geographical center of British Columbia, so-called British Columbia. Prince George had a demonstration through the downtown streets in a town of 80,000, there were 500 people that marched through downtown, which was pretty good in comparison to, you know, the cities in Alberta, like Edmonton, which can never get that many people, you know, marching in opposition to tar sands expansion. And that one was a really loud opposition to Enbridge. All kinds of communities, from the Carrier to the Kitsan, Tsimshian, Wet'suwet'en, all these different people were saying, you know, we're unanimous and united in opposition that we don't want Enbridge to go through. And not only that, but it's not going to go through because all of these territories and communities and people are standing in the way so that it won't be done. And I feel like the final nail in the coffin was Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs. There are two of them. It was right around that time that in Smithers, B.C., which is in between Kinemat and Prince George on Highway 16, they interrupted an Enbridge meeting, and they brought in an eagle feather and said, this is our traditional way of dealing with trespassers and people that are illegally entering our territory without our permission. They said that this is the first warning. When they give you this eagle feather, it's an issue saying, next time, if you don't abide by us or consult with us, you'll be physically ejected. And traditionally, the third warning is death.
Yep.
But in this term, it's death to the project.
Yep.
So Enbridge immediately shut down the meeting. They left. They left the town and you know, they postponed the meeting to another location. So you know, that was just increasing momentum against Enbridge. And
right.
Just recently, they've been trying to do some damage control with their PR image, with the public image, seeing that, well, these people only speak for, you know, minority, and that we have, you know, the right leadership in place who are promoting our project, when in actuality, they only have a few handpicked people who don't speak for the majority of the people.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is. It's just so good. You can't imagine how good it is to my heart to hear you saying all about these really strong moves that have been made by the people that love the land out there, and the people that should be deciding the future. Just to hear that they're just standing up and just telling that Enbridge, you know, that it's not going to happen, that no, we don't want this, get out, you know, we don't want this. That is such a great example to everybody around the world. And any other instances like this come along, and there are plenty of them coming along. The thing that comes to mind to me, and we're not seeing nearly, you know, I hope the people in the southern and central parts of New York State will somehow become aware of this good example you are setting. See, there's this proposal to do the hydraulic fracturing for the shale natural gas. This is another one of these dirty fuels, and it's being proposed in New York State now. It's done in West Virginia, it's done in Pennsylvania, it's done in lots of states, but they had never done it in New York before, and now they propose to do it, and many in the public have come out in opposition to it. But there are also people that are selling, you know, the leases to these companies that want to do the gas drilling. So I really cannot say, and it is because it hasn't happened, there hasn't been anything as significant and as strong as the kind of opposition that you guys have mounted to the Enbridge pipeline with this natural gas fracturing here in New York State. And I'm just hoping that, you know, as we see these good examples, that the level of the opposition, and, you know, just how far people want to go and just take a stand, I'm hoping that will change in the direction of protecting the earth and, you know, having it be the way the average person that just wants to have a, you know, a pleasant life and enjoy the, you know, the good things of nature and the outdoors, if they would have their way, you know, rather than these big corporations. So let's tell me now, so you did a lot of work on the Enbridge pipeline opposition, and that kind of set you up and got you, you know, probably the Sierra Club started thinking about you being a good person to have in their Prairie chapter. Tell us about, you know, moving to the Prairie chapter of the Sierra Club and what kind of work you're doing with them now.
Well, in Edmonton here, you know, this entire province is fueled by the tar sands industry. Like, I believe it's like 75% to 80% of the economy is from the tar sands. And, you know, the tar sands as an overall project is the largest industrial project on Earth. And, you know, the tar sands tailing waste, the toxic tailing waste sites are visible from space. So this is like ground zero. And more particular, more specifically, that's Fort Chipewyan, Fort Mackay, and Fort McMurray, which is, you know, directly impacted by the tar sands. They have 15 mines now, plants operating in that entire region. So those communities are, you know, heavily inundated. And, you know, just being overwhelmed by the toxic emissions from the air, toxic air quality, toxic water, and the animals that can't eat anymore. Those people, the Dene and Cree people and Métis people who live there, they can't rely upon their moose anymore. The caribou is all gone. The fish has cancerous sores in it, has tumors, and they're mutated. They can no longer drink the water. They're afraid to even swim in the water. And meanwhile, the government has like little to no regulations in that industry. And I just feel like the level of injustice is, you know, the longer justice delays, the longer justice denied. It's like a quote somewhere. But just from seeing, you know, I did a flyover a few years ago in a little Cessna plane. And people call it Mordor, they call it, you know, apocalypse wasteland, because for miles and miles you see nothing but devastated, plundered earth. And it's just a very, you know, it's a huge thing to not, you can't just ignore it. It's not just an Alberta issue, it's an international issue, it's a global
right.
issue. And I feel like, you know, if the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline and tanker traffic, and there's also three other companies that are accompanying Enbridge. Enbridge is the biggest one, so that's why they're targeted. But these four companies who want to expand tar sands into our territory on the West Coast, you know, it's a very big threat, and a lot of people feel like it's going to be like a galvanizing, you know, environmental issue, a struggle for the next decade. And, you know, Enbridge has said that because of all of this opposition and resistance, they pushed back their plans another couple of years. So their plans have been delayed a few more years because of popular opposition to their projects. And I just feel like, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in Alberta, and, you know, whoever can, you know, lend their passion and their spirit to that struggle, you know, it's a good thing, because out of all areas in North America, Alberta is like it's like a Texas. It's like the Canadian version of Texas North. And, you know, there's not very much political opposition or history of resistance or dissent in Alberta. So the most pressing issue that unites people in opposition is the tar sands industry. And I just feel like, you know, just historically, because of the Hudson's Bay Company, which formed the first colonial governments in our territory as well as in northern Alberta, the first one was in Fort Chipewyan. And just for me, historically, you know, there's a connection there.
Yep.
And I feel like, you know, our struggle is their struggle, and their struggle is our struggle.
Yeah, sometime in the near future, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. O'Connor, the MD that is caring for the First Nations people there in Fort Chipewyan. And I'm really looking forward to that. I've read about his work. I've talked to other people that are familiar with what he's done. But I've never actually done an on-the-record interview with him. So I'm really looking forward to see our group is Cancer Action New York, and we started out in January of 2000 here in the St. Lawrence River Valley, just seeing so much cancer and so much pollution that we felt, you know, we needed to have an organization that had this really kind of clear goal of bringing reductions, you know, minimizing the releases of pollutant carcinogens to the environment so that we would start reducing the cancer problem amongst the people that live here. And in the process of doing that, we started realizing how just such a huge job to really minimize all this pollution that we're downstream from the Great Lakes, we're downwind from some of the most heavily industrialized places in the world. And so, you know, we began to realize that together with minimizing these releases eventually through a long, long process, that first thing we needed to really do was educate the public about the existence of all this poison that was in their air and their water and their food and their bodies, and to get them to avoid this poison as much as possible, because there are things you can do, like just say, like, not eating the fish from the river and not truly not consuming any animal fat from the whole economy. So we've begun doing that kind of education, and it's a rocky road because the politicians and the business people don't like it. But we have just kept doing it, and as the years have passed, people have begun to honor us for doing it, and they're glad we're doing it because they... But truth is, there's a huge amount of power in the people, the individual person, and then them together, the grassroots, wanting to bring an end to this large amount of cancer, to this cancer epidemic. So we're finding that as we just keep doing it, you know, just day after day, month to month, year to year, that we're building this closeness to people and this kind of good record and this history and this vibe of being moving into the future on something that needs to change. And it is kind of cool, you know. I felt frustrated, very, very frustrated at first about it, because it went so slowly and there was just so much bad vibe and, you know, like pushback and all this kind of like negativity. But as we just kept doing it, we gradually built it more and more into this thing of just being strong and doing the right thing, and it is feeling more positive now. It feels really good, and I'm sure that's the kind of thing you're experiencing with the work out there. Tell me, as far as, is there going to be, you know, certainly I suspect that they will continue to do the amount of tar sands mining and, you know, all that's associated with that. They're going to keep doing that for quite a while, I'm thinking, you know. I don't see, you know, as far as what I can see of the opposition, it hasn't reached a point where it's even close to saying, okay, shut them down today. I kind of suspect that won't happen. But is there going to be, do you think that people will allow them to grow larger, you know, to actually open up more mines and just onto new lands and just keep on just growing out of control like this?
Well, that's what a lot of activists and environmental organizations and a few government offices have been calling for the past few years, is no new approvals and put a moratorium on future developments, and specifically on toxic tailing ponds. And communities in the region, like Fort Chipewyan, Fort Mackay, Fort McMurray, and a lot of the other communities close nearby, are calling for no new developments until cumulative health impacts and holistic studies are done to assess the damage that has already been done, because it hasn't been done.
Yep.
And not only that, but there have been some independent studies done, and those are what, you know, really shed light on the truth of the amount of damage, so socially, environmentally, economically, and you know, spiritually, that the land has been devastated. But what really needs to happen is action. You know, there's already been studies done. The government has done very weak studies. The industry has provided studies, but they're all downplayed and minimized. And what needs to happen is no new approvals until people can really have a good look at the problem so they can deal with it. And what needs to happen on a larger extent within all of Alberta, for all the people that live in Alberta and depend upon work in Alberta, is a very transient population, especially in Fort McMurray, is a psychological shift, like a paradigm shift. People, you know, stop thinking, why as humanity we're so dependent upon fossil fuel extraction, which is unsustainable, non-renewable, and is very finite, and it's completely destroying the earth without any renewable solutions. Such as in Alberta, in particular, there's a huge potential for solar energy and wind power, and it's not been utilized, and it needs to be utilized by communities and not taken over by corporations or the government.
Yep.
And, you know, the power needs to be put back in people's hands and within their own backyard, the people that live in the region who need to see that. So a lot of people have taken to doing their own studies or, you know, making alliances with scientists and incredible people who can provide very good data that stands up to any kind of data. And in particular, just last month, we just finished the Bucket Brigade training with this organization called Global Community Monitor based out of San Francisco. We did a training in Fort McMurray with people from Fort Mackay and Fort McMurray First Nation, and another one in Peace River, which is in Lubicon Cree territory. And what that did was it trained people in the region to develop a, you know, affordable but reliable way to gather toxic air emissions, up to 70 different gases that are related from tar sands, such as benzene, which
which have been shown to cause rare cancers such as blood cancer.
Right.
And there's a community just northeast of Edmonton. It's called Fort Saskatchewan, but it's known as Upgrader Alley. And there's one family in particular that lives there. They have almost every single person in that immediate family has passed away from blood cancer, which is a rare cancer. And even in Fort Chipewyan, which is a community of only 1,200 people, that blood cancer is very disproportionately higher than it is in a big city such as Edmonton. You know, they see that type of blood cancer in a population ratio of like 1 to 100,000. And in a community of 1,200, they've already had, I forget the number, it's over 10. Or it's very disproportionately high anyway.
Right.
You know,
right.
Much more higher. People are under the age of 30 have passed away from it already.
Well, it's so good to hear that you guys are figuring out a way to get that air data, because I had talked to you. Are you familiar with Dr. Kevin Timoney?
Yeah.
I've talked to him, and I've interviewed him, I think, once or twice, and he was looking at the chemicals, say, the arsenic and the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, these PAHs, in the water of the Athabasca River, and considering how that was affecting, you know, the wildlife and the public and the quality of the river and all this. But I hadn't seen anything where people were gathering this information on the air impacts, which are certainly as important, you know, very, very important part of all this damage that's being done. So it's so good to hear. How did this come about? You know, is this something that the Sierra Club was, you know, pivot, you know, that took part in, you know, bringing to happen there in Alberta?
Yeah, my friend and co-worker, Sheila Muxlow, she's a director of the chapter here. She's a few years ago, she was working for another organization. There was a conference called Keepers of the Water, Keepers of the Athabasca Conference in Fort Chipewyan, and she met Denny Larson from Global Community Monitor and a few other people from the region that wanted to initiate a process to gather the air quality, the air samples, because the water has already been collected.
Yep.
And the data on the fish was being collected, and data on the moose is actually starting to be collected right now too. So one gap that was missing was testing air and giving the people in the region the means to do that themselves, because you can't rely upon government, can't rely upon industry.
Right.
So they started doing that, and we're waiting to see the results in early 2011, but there's a few studies that have been done, and it's mostly to put pressure on the government and the industry, saying that, you know what, people have the power, they're not completely powerless or hopeless or helpless to not do this themselves, and the parts that they're using are industrial grade, so it's actually the same materials that are being used by the mining companies in the tar sands. So, and the results are being sent to one of the top 5 labs in the United States. So the data that is being produced and analyzed, you know, stands up to any kind of scientific monitoring.
Yep. It's just so good to hear that people are accomplishing that much, you know, to protect their communities and their lives and their, you know, their health. And like you say, with the moose, tell me, I had not heard anything about this piece of, you know, the data, this look at how this is impacting the moose. Can you share a little bit on that?
Yeah, the moose and the caribou too. The caribou have been pushed further north, and they're an endangered species. But the moose in particular, they've been impacted in I think it's like western central Alberta, and they found high levels of cadmium in the liver of moose, and you know, very, you know, disproportionately and unnaturally higher than normal, and so, you know, a lot of people in Alberta, in the rural regions, you know, still rely upon moose for their traditional diet.
Right.
Very important part of the culture and, you know, and subsistence. And, you know, those moose being impacted like that, you know, the moose, they can't tell the difference between when they go to, you know, like a salt pad, when emissions are dropping on it, when polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and benzenes and these kinds of emissions are, you know, landing in that region, and the moose don't tell the difference. You know, they still go there.
Right.
It's the same with the toxic tailings waste. You know, ducks will land in there thinking it's a lake, and moose and beaver have been shown to, you know, show up there. People have seen tracks in the snow leading right into it, to this toxic sludge pools. And just last month, there was one called the CNRL Horizon tailings waste just north of Fort Mackay. And it only had three sides to it. The company CNRL, Canadian Natural Resources Limited, purposefully only built a three-sided dam with one side open, and they believe that the missing barrier would just be protected by a natural clay sandbar. And just last month, that's when all that toxic sludge started leaking into the bog up there, into the marshlands or the peat bog. And there's beaver dams in there. There's people have seen moose tracks around the area. There's birds flying around, and it's impacting those people. It's impacting the animals. It's impacting people that hunt and trap in that area. And some people still do that. You know, they say this is our traditional food, and if our food's getting impacted, our food's gonna get killed off, then we're getting killed off too. This is genocide. People are starting to use that term because the disproportionate amount of health impacts and death in that area is, you know, very significantly higher than places that aren't directly impacted and in close proximity to natural resources extraction industries. And one thing we heard from a community member in Fort Mackay is that all of the children had asthma, so it's just expected to be common that, you know, every single child that lives there in the long term develops asthma, and they no longer have natural deaths. All of their deaths are from cancer.
So tell us, where is Fort Mackay? You know, I've heard of Fort McMurray, I've heard of Fort Chipewyan. Where's Fort Mackay?
Fort Mackay is about 45 minutes northwest of Fort McMurray on Highway 63.
Okay.
From Edmonton, Highway 63 is the highway north to Fort McMurray and the tar sands.
Okay.
And Fort Mackay is surrounded by six tar sands plant sites. And
oh, wow.
Just before you get into Fort Mackay, there's a Syncrude plant site, and then there's a Suncor plant site on both sides of the highway, and those are the original tar sands mines in that area. And they've been there for 40 years. And that community is just inundated with all of the pollution and contamination from these tar sands. And we did a tar sands bucket brigade training. We did a toxic tour site visit, and in that case, we were visiting people who were sharing stories about, you know, when emissions are really bad. And when we were there on that particular day, we could feel and smell the heavy tar smell in the air, but the smokestack from Syncrude, the plume of smoke was going straight up in the air, but usually it flows right into the community and, you know, down river, downstream, right all the way to Fort Chipewyan. And Fort Mackay, you know, is anywhere you go, you sense that in the air. There's no escaping it. So the people there, you know, are putting up with a lot. Like, they're developing sores in their bodies, and Syncrude even they purposely put a few buffalo in a yard. I think they call it a bison farm or something. But those buffalo are probably the most toxic buffalo in all of North America, and that's their idea of, like, biological offsets. You know, it's a false solution, saying, well, we're destroying the environment, but we're doing this. Same thing they're doing with the forestry. They have this concept of carbon marketing and cap and trade model. It's originally developed by Enron to create sacrifice zones. While they devastate one zone, they'll plant like a tree farm, artificial tree farm somewhere else, and say, "Well, this is a carbon credit, and because of this is going to help offset the damage we're doing over here." And you know, Fort Mackay is directly in the middle of all of that.
So truly, like you say, this started many decades ago. So to actually grasp, to actually kind of get some thought in one's head, you know, to kind of conceptualize and just have some idea of what is involved, it's many decades of people living in places that just gradually became more and more and more toxic to the extent where it certainly is harmful for them to try to subsist and get the foods, you know, the natural wild foods that they used to eat. And this is all taking place over a huge area for a long period of time. I would love to see a book. You know, I read that book that Nikki Farouk wrote, The Tar Sands and Dirty Oil, but that was so much just about kind of like the political side of this and the economic side of it. And a little, you know, there was a considerable bit about the ponds, you know, about those tailings ponds. But it'd be so cool to see a book about, you know, what it has been like during the past several decades for the First Nations people that were right there seeing, you know, their wildlife become unhealthy to eat and, you know, seeing seeing all these diseases come along and just gradually coming to feel kind of like it was just this kind of the normal situation. They had that awful smell in the air. Wow, what a story.
Yeah. There's a movie that, a documentary that came out recently. It's called H2 Oil.
Okay.
And they have, there's some interviews with people, long-term residents from that region who are talking about the changes they've seen. People in Fort Chipewyan, Fort Mackay, Fort McMurray, and they talk about the history as hunters and fishermen, and people living in the land that use the land permanently and long-term as a living tradition. Seeing the changes that they've seen within a couple of generations, and that's a very good one. It's called H2 Oil.
H2 Oil.
Yeah.
What's that name mean?
It refers to, you know, the water crisis in Alberta.
Okay, I get it. Yeah. The water's a big part of this. Yeah,
yeah, the typical conventional extraction rate for tar sands is to produce just one barrel of oil, they use sometimes up to 6 barrels of water and 3 barrels of earth. Produce one barrel of oil. So it's a very costly process that, you know, just is very unsustainable, and in an economical sense it's not very productive when you consider like how finite it is. It's basically, you know, rush in, you know, extract it and create a huge mess and not deal with it, but, you know, try to make as much profit in the short term. It's a very sloppy and very devastating process. And the water crisis in Alberta is the extent that, you know, within, I believe it's 2020, I forget the exact numbers, but the water crisis in Alberta is, you know, is the lowest it's ever been. The deltas, or the delta glacier that a lot of communities rely upon, and the mountain ranges, the few mountain ranges surrounding Alberta, you know, are receding at a very tremendous rate. And pretty soon Alberta will have to look at other places to import water, to trade for clean sources of water, because the rate that the tar sands are using the water, especially in the Athabasca River, is to such an extent that it was just shown last week in a study called "As Long as the Rivers Flow" by the Firelight Group in collaboration with Mikisew First Nation and Athabasca and Fort Chipewyan First Nation, saying that as long as these tar sands companies still extract billions of liters of fresh water from the Athabasca River, we can no longer implement our treaty rights. We can no longer continue our traditional practices because the water levels are so low. Our boats and our canoes can no longer get across the river. Not only that, they can no longer drink from the river, no longer use the water, because it's just being dried right up from the tar sands. And there's no sustainable solutions that have been promoted by the government or the industry. You know, one corporation, Suncor, has implemented this dry tailings technology, but there hasn't been any studies showing, you know, where do the tailings end up. You know, they evaporate, they end up somewhere. They don't just disappear.
Right. Boy, it just sounds like this hellish activity of a bunch of uncaring, greedy people just ruining one of the... we've been here in New York State, we still had our interest in wilderness. I have a twin brother, and we would always, you know, read these books, that Bradford and your book about going and living off of land in British Columbia. So I think it was in 1978, we went out to British Columbia, and we were there in the Prince George, and we were at the at Moberly Lake campsite there on that route that goes up to Fort St. John, and we were in Fort St. John too, and we were kind of thinking about maybe going on up the Alaska Highway, but we had really, our main plan was to just live in the bush there in British Columbia. And we'd look off to some of those mountain ranges, you know, from some of the highways and back across some of the ranches, and, you know, just kind of yearn to do that, but we weren't ready for it. We had never, it was a dream, but we weren't prepared to, you know, live the dream. You know, we hadn't really done any large amount of wilderness living yet. And then we came back here to the east and started doing more and more of that, and up in Quebec, up in the James Bay area, and then out in Saskatchewan, and then my brother went down to Montana, was down there a bunch, and he's up in Alaska right now, and he certainly is a very wild part of Alaska. But as far as that wonderful Athabasca River country, we surely, you know, that Peace River and the Athabasca River, those were the names of the rivers that we were, you know, so excited about, and yet we never really got to experience them when they were, you know, pristine and not
impacted by this nightmare here. So it's terrible how like life goes by so fast, and such big things happen that I have to say that in my lifetime, I've seen it get a lot worse. I'm 54, and boy, the St. Lawrence River's a sicker river than it ever was, and the air around my home farm, nobody would want to breathe it because all it smells like is cow shit and diesel exhaust from this huge factory farm that's across the road. And we didn't cause that, and we didn't want it, and we opposed it, but still have it. And all the people around here that, you know, get cancer and have all these other diseases, you know, that aren't normal, that are part of being poisoned. The big thing that's changed in my mind is I feel like we all have been poisoned, and we ought to do something about it, serious, and just take a stand and really just bring this huge revolution in the way everything is. Everything needs to change, and truly everything needs to change, and it's not happening, and it's frustrating, and some anger in it, too. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, you guys truly, there with the tar sands, that is more nightmarish than anything that I've lived with, and yet I'm thinking, you know, truly I'm thinking of Viva the Revolution, you know, I just love to have, you know, I just kind of feel like it's so crappy, you know, just so much less than the way I would like it to be, to have these corporations and these political people that are just their lapdogs calling the shots, run the show, deciding how things are going to be for the future, deciding how things are right here, right now, and it's all to their best interest and nothing to my, I don't want any of it. I'm trying to figure out how to stop driving a car that burns gasoline because I really feel, I just don't feel right about, you know, being an American and getting all that tar sands, you know, sourced gas and diesel and living off the use of that stuff. And I talked to this guy I know from high school, and he's saying, let's start burning alcohol, you know, it's like, get some stills going and produce some alcohol from the, you know, the grass or the dandelions or the trees or, you know, anything we can throw in these, you know, these fermentation chambers and, you know, just distill it and get the alcohol and drive a car from Brazil, you know. I'd rather do that than just be in any way connected to this. Like you say, this tar sand thing, it is the moment in time. It's the hugest environmental conflict that ever came before us, and it will be, probably. I don't know what else could come along. I think it's going to be the struggle of all struggles, you know, as far as, you know, environmentalists and corporate people go and government people go. So, I don't know. I want to cut myself off from it, and I don't want to stop driving. I don't want to stop driving. But I want to, you know, burn something different in the car, and then I want to just keep. I'm coming out there. I love Saskatchewan. We were in central Saskatchewan at La Ronge, you know, and around there, this Lake Wapawika. And that's such a beautiful place. And think that it's getting rained down with acid rain and snowed down with acid snow. And they're talking about moving the tar sands, you know, mining into Saskatchewan. I'll tell you, I'd be out there right now if it wasn't for a couple of personal issues that keep me stuck here in New York State. Because it seems like I just feel very excited by it. It seems like the battle of all battles to me.
Yeah, it's definitely a very, you know, very international struggle. And what needs, you know, people, the only way it's going to happen is people, you know, are empowered to the extent that they change their reliance and their lifestyles upon, you know, what they rely upon. And the thing with that is the government and the industry and, you know, apologists for the tar sands always use that as a counter-argument to criticism and opposition to tar sands, saying, well, if people are you know, calling out the tar sands as devastating, as ecocide, as destroying the environment and natural life, then why are those same people, you know, driving vehicles or relying upon this, you know, this energy grid system to continue to live? They're hypocrites. The thing with that, though, is, you know, people are placed in this capitalist system, this modern industrialized system, and a lot of people, especially people living in rural regions, such as First Nations people, such as, you know, farmers, they walk in two worlds. They could still, a lot of people can still live without relying upon that. There's some communities in particular, there's one Lubicon Cree community in northern Alberta called Little Buffalo, and some houses in that community, they never had running water, and they're one of the last in all of Alberta to have, you know, running water and electricity. And they're the only nation in Alberta, indigenous nation, that's never signed treaties or surrendered their territory, just like my people back on the West Coast. coast. And you consider that, like, in a country considered a very first world condition, there are some communities that still live in fourth world conditions. And fourth world is like a metaphor. It's used by a very influential Shikwetmek leader named George Manuel in the 60s. And the fourth world refers to the fact that even though we're living in the first world, we live in third world conditions. But it's called the fourth world because the majority of it is indigenous territory and it's never been surrendered. But the wealth that an American and Canadian empires have built upon internationally, which they project themselves as an international superpower, have been built off of the displaced territories, the labor, and the theft of land from indigenous people. So that entire system is built upon that. And that's a counter to that argument that people are hypocrites because we're forced in this system, and people that are living without the system, living like off of the energy grid, you know, it's a very difficult thing, but it's a very honorable and noble challenge to take to prove that, you know, people can be self-sustainable, people can live autonomously in places that have experienced those kinds of cultural revolutions, such as, for instance, the Zapatistas in Mexico, where they have autonomous communities, they have their own clinics, they have their own schools that aren't run by some government or some corporation that's, you know, intent on controlling, like creating an elitist class that, you know, profits off of the suffering of the majority.
Yep. Yeah, I'm just hoping that as the years pass by, and I hope it happens fast too, because I don't want to miss all of it. You know, the life is short, and we truly the best thing for the earth, the best thing for people, the best thing for all the good things will be if these changes happen fast. As far as like what you're saying, get away from the corporate elite kind of controlled experience of life, get away from governments being so tightly together with these corporate elite, and these they're truly crazy. It's crazy to do those tar sands, you know. It's not just greedy, it's crazy on top of that. There was plenty of greed involved in, say, the railroads and the, you know, the oil and gas drilling, and that was nothing compared to these tar sands, you know. Horrible slaughtering the buffalo and horrible, you know, pointing all those gas wells and oil wells in, but nothing as horrible, as even close to as horrible as the tar sands with those ponds and with these pipelines and with, like you said, this whole thing of the processing of wasting so much water and then putting out so much pollution because it's such a dirty source of fuel, it's crazy on top of it being greedy. And I do hope it ends quickly, because I want to experience the thrill of being part of bringing it to an end and just having a better world, you know, that's there when it's done and we move on to something better than that. So it can't happen fast enough for me, and I'm just, Dustin, what's your thinking? You know, where do you think the energy lies? You know, the good vibe, the good intention, the people of, you know, goodness and honor and character and all these good things about being a person. Where does that exist for stopping the tar sands? You know, is it, you know, are there people, lots of people, going to come together on this and do that? You know, here and now, you know, here in like the decade of 2010, you know?
I think it comes to individual and family experiences. When you see some people who were former miners and workers in the tar sands, and they have, you know, experience and revelations where they see, well, is this kind of legacy you want to live for future generations? And some people have, you know, start having families, and they'd look around and see this wasteland around them, and see this is the kind of future we want for our kids. You know, no clean air to breathe, no clean water to drink, no safe wildlife, you know, healthy animals to eat. And all we'd have is this, you know, genetically modified food from supermarkets, from Mexico and Southern California, which is unsustainable and exploitative for people who live there, who work in those places. That's not a future that people want to see. You know, people think that and think of long-term visioning, then they realize, you know, this is not a project that people would want to continue to pass on to the next generation. And a lot of people that are impacted by the tar sands, downstream communities and First Nations farmers and settlers that see the results, that have seen the changes over the generations, you know, see that, you know, as long as this continues, you know, we're leaving more and more of our toxic legacy for the next generations, and people should at least have the foresight that, you know, Indigenous people have been seeing all along, you know, at least can see seven generations down the road what kind of future you want to leave for those people. And it comes with that. It comes with personal revolution. It comes with decolonizing and, you know, unprogramming that kind of mindset within yourself individually and then within your immediate circle, your family, your friends, your community, and, you know, their networks, you know, the larger population. It has to start from a person's, you know, psychological beliefs and spiritual values and the way they perceive themselves in the world, the way they see themselves as connected, or they see themselves as someone, you know, the whole Eurocentric and the belief of dominion over nature, you know, controlling and exploiting nature. And, you know, a paradigm shift really needs to happen for people to psychologically unravel that kind of mindset to see a better future, because, you know, there's no way that any tar sands executives would ever, you know, live near the tar sands regions. You know, there's no, the CEOs, all of the top business decision-making policymakers, they don't live there because they don't have to see the results or be affected by it, impacted by the results. And a lot of people would call that environmental racism because of the disproportionate proximity of tar sands operations, mining operations, forestry, pulp operations, all of these different very toxic industries. Are not affecting the people that are, you know, running the businesses up there.
That's right. Yeah, it's all very unfair. It's all very bad to the point of evil in my way of seeing things. I'm not a Christian. You know, I honor Jesus. I think that was a good, you know, certainly a powerful, wonderful being, whether it was God or person. That, you know, I'm not certain. I honor that though. But as far as religion, I don't really have religion. It's more like this. When I need help and when I'm thinking about good things happening, I think of good spirits, and I just want to think that, you know, there's this goodness that exists in the spiritual world that is always battling with the evil that's in the spiritual world. And when people talk to me and just tell me, well, there's no good, there's no evil, it's just all this, you know, way of people looking at things, I disagree. I think there's always been good, always been evil. It's both in the world we're a part of, in the spiritual world, and I think that if people were to start rising spiritually and, you know, just move toward the goodness that there is in themselves and in their communities and in the spirit world, then I think that maybe we would have this additional part of being human that we could bring to bear upon these awful corporate people. It does come down to that. It truly comes down to us, our tribe, against their tribe. You know, they're never going to stop. They're not going to just... They love having that power. They love having this... You know, this is what they want. They got it going. They want to exploit the earth and, you know, have power socially and politically and economically out of all that. They're not going to give it up. No one would give that up because it's not in their best... In their personal, you know, the way their head is right now, best interest to give it up. It's what they want. So we just feel like we just got to fight with them and stop them from doing this. And it's good that it be all nonviolent and, you know, just this thing of goodness opposing badness and evil. And I just hope that what you're doing there, together with what we're doing here, because we're doing this program, this Stop Tar Sands program. Our state is considering having a low carbon fuel standard that would make the tar sands, you know, gas and oil, you know, impossible, you know, wouldn't be okay, it wouldn't be legal for our state to accept that here if we, you know, do adopt this low carbon fuel standard. California has adopted the standard, but I don't know how it's affected. See, I'm not all that familiar with California being on the other side of the country. I don't know whether that's, you know, they stopped accepting fuel that comes from tar sands. I know that it's getting here in pipelines and it's getting refined in the Great Lakes Basin, and it's, you know, it's part of, I'm sure I'm burning off from tar sands, you know, in my car, you know, tonight when I go, you know, when I leave here, I'll be burning that. But hopefully that all of us together will make a difference, and I would do more. I'm going to ask just one more question before we wrap this up. What could people, you know, what would be the best thing, you know, if people in New York were going to do something in the next couple of years, you know, to bring it into the tar sands, or like to move strongly in that direction, you know, what would you recommend? You know, what would make the most, you know, impact? You know, what would get the most, you know, goodness going on the side of the tribe that's bringing an end to tar sands? You know, what do you want from New York?
Solidarity actions when different communities, not only in Alberta but across Canada and across the states, take action against a specific project. Say, for instance, two months ago there was a protest action that was carried across Canada. It was called No Tar Sands, No Pipelines, No Tankers, No Problem.
Wow.
And that was done to show the large extent to which this entire infrastructure is related to tar sands pipelines, to tar sands tanker traffic, tar sands infrastructure and railways and highways, and the false solutions that are being promoted by government and industry, but that people in different regions can take an action on the same day targeting the same company, and especially putting pressure on financial investment. And Toronto and New York are centers of financial investment and recognized on an international scale, of course. So places that are, you know, bringing embarrassment and shame and shedding light on the truth of, you know, to which extent corporations and governments and banks are financing tar sands, you know, you can see that, you know, these are corporate criminals. You know, as corporate criminals, they should be charged as criminals for destroying and committing crime against humanity and the earth, and not providing any solutions for it. Because when you see a tar sands devastation, you know, there's no going back to that. There's no reclamation. It's a very simple solution: is just leave it in the ground. So people, especially in downstream communities, you know, are calling for more solidarity actions from allies and people of like minds and spirits to take action where they can and to shed light on this, to, you know, bring international attention to it and say that, you know what, people are standing up to this and people are demanding a different future, and the governments in power and the corporations are do not speak for the people. So we need a new form of government. We need new forms of government. We need new forms of sustainable solutions. And people need to have that within their own power, you know, within their own communities, and not be continually regulated. It needs to happen from people, and that's the whole meaning of self-determination.
Well, so tell us the names of a couple of websites to keep an eye on, so we'll know when some of these solidarity times come along.
There's a few websites. There's one called tarsandswatch.org.
Okay.
Oilsandstruth.org.
And so if we go to those websites, they're going to have a calendar or like an upcoming events or something, you know, tile, and then we look at that, and then we'll see the dates of some of the solidarity type events that are coming along.
Yeah, I want to
do one of them. I'd like to do one of them, you know, right here in the St. Lawrence River Valley. You know, we burn a lot of fuel. There's you know, pretty high population here, and not like New York City or anything. We're at the other part of the end of the state from that, but up here we have this whole issue with the seaway, you know, this international shipping route of these huge ocean-going vessels that burn this an outrageous amount of diesel fuel. So, I mean, if you really totaled up all the combustion of fuel that's taking place in any one particular part of New York State, I'm thinking we're, you know, right up there with everybody else. And another thing we want to do, I was just talking with a highway department person, and he's in the town of Canton, which is our county seat here in St. Lawrence County. He's the superintendent of the highways there. And he made this very important point to me, and I'm not going to forget it for a long time. I'm going to do something about it. He was saying if our federal government here in the U.S., and Canada too for that matter, if both of our governments would reduce the speed of the tractor-trailer trucks on the highways from, you know, these, you know, they go 65, 70, 75, you know, and it's legal, they let them do it. If they reduce that speed down to 55, he said there will be billions of gallons of fuel saved, and there will be no shortages, and there will be lower prices, and there will be less pollution, and there will be less demand for tar sands activity, all by changing 10 mile an hour the speed that these tractor-trailer trucks are allowed to run, because they're just running at such an inefficient speed to just go so fast that it's not right. They're just doing something that should not be allowed. It's just harmful to everybody.
Yeah. Not only that, but those semi-trailer trucks, especially in Highway 63 from Edmonton to Marine Tuformakai and the tar sands region, there's so many animals that are killed, the wildlife death and roadkill on the road. And I saw a picture somewhere of someone was holding a sign, holding a banner, and had a picture taken right next to where a semi-trailer was passing by a highway where this animal was just destroyed, and its guts were all over the highway. And the sign said, "Millions of animals die each year to make way for your fat ass."
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Pretty. It's just. Oh, I really truly pray to the good spirits that this ugliness will be forgotten, you know, and gone beyond, so we can forget it. You know, the only way we'll ever forget it is to move far away from it. You know, higher. Just people rise up spiritually, and it's been so good talking to you, Dustin. You know, you guys are. I tell you, I envy you for having lived the life you've lived. You know, I certainly would have liked to have, you know, been a part of that nation you were part of out there in British Columbia that got you going on this path right here, you know. And, you know, I'm happy to have lived my life, too. But, you know, there's certainly some lives like yours that seems to be quite appealing, you know. And I'm hoping you have great successes in your future that started out this beautifully, you know. It's been great talking to you.
Great, thank you.
Yep, hope you will have a wonderful solstice. You know, the solstice is almost here, and it's a powerful holiday.
Okay, yeah, you too. Take care.
Goodbye, Dustin.
Okay, thanks.
This is Don Hussig with Loving the Earth, Pollution-Free Revolution. We've just been talking with Dustin Johnson of the Sierra Club Prairie Chapter. Dustin has a long history. Long before working for Sierra Club, he's been working to stop tar sands. Honor to Dustin Johnson and the First Nations of British Columbia and Alberta and Saskatchewan. These are wonderful people that will be a huge part of bringing the good change of stopping these tar sands. Have a wonderful solstice holiday, and we're looking for a spiritual revolution. Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network. Bye.